You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 374. You know, John, after weeks of coming up with dumb bullshit intros to this show, just to do it straight feels kind of naked, you know?
Well, we're doing our back to basics record, you know, where we got nothing to hide. Kind of like Johnny Cash's. This is our Johnny Cash's American series, episode 374. We're old, decrepit, thinking about death.
That's why that guy with the beard is standing in the corner glowering at me. Oh, so anyways, yeah, this is the Punk News Podcast. We talk about stuff that happened in the past week in punk rock. I'm Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the show tonight, Mr. John Gentile out of the East Coast to not triangulate you.
Right? East Coast, here I am, baby.
The East Coast. We won't even say what eats East Coast. East Coast of
could be
Japan,
Burma,
you know, East Coast of Burma.
Bhutan,
it's
Paraguay.
You'll never know. So, and then also, out of Brooklyn and not afraid to complain about it. You're out of Brooklyn, right,
Sam? Yeah. Yeah.
you said that as if, like, if anyone actually knew what I mean, it's not Brooklyn.
Brooklyn's weird. I don't know.
Like, do people who are actually from Brooklyn, would they laugh at you saying you're from Brooklyn and you actually live in some horrible sub-Brooklyn?
No, I'm actually in Brooklyn, and I've lived in New York all my life, because, you know, everyone in Brooklyn is actually not from Brooklyn.
Well, see, that's a little bit like up here, where every time I see press for a band that's from some Ontario town that is not Toronto, but is close enough to Toronto, whenever they get press in the States, they'll be like, band from Toronto, and I'm like, that band is from Mississauga, that band isn't from Toronto, and it drives me crazy, so I don't know if it was like that sort of thing. So anyways, Sammy B from Brooklyn, welcome back. You haven't been on the show in a while.
Yeah, I've been hibernating.
Under your pile of IKEA Kallaxes.
All of my IKEA Kallaxes.
I thought they were called Expedits.
Well, they discontinued them.
Oh. Yeah, the Expedits are amazing, but they made a cheaper version called the Kallax, which looks cheaper.
It's lighter. It was like a shipping thing. Where yeah. They're like, hey, if we make the walls of this slightly thinner, then when we add it all up, we've saved like $50 million. It's one of those deals.
See, I buy all my Expedits used because they don't really go bad.
Wait.
I mean, I will have you know that I am right now sitting at a desk that I built out of an Expedits. So I'm just really, really in the zone with this conversation here. Like, I am literally touching one all over as we talk. So we are going to talk about a bunch of stuff that happened this week. There's some grim news. There's some unhappy news this week. There's there's a few things maybe that are on the happier side. But
we got some delightful stuff.
But a lot of woe.
We have some delightful stuff here, Adam. You know what they say? Always look on the brighter side of life.
If I could whistle, I would whistle you that thing from Life of Brian. So, anyways. before we get going, let's do the mail here. We are, as we record this show, just in case someone comes and listens to this at some point, we are two episodes behind actually posting. So the reaction that we're getting on this show is going to be a couple episodes old. So, you know, we'll have to cope. So if you're listening to this and you're like, where's my letter? We'll catch up.
And actually, we got so much mail, we're not even going to get to it all today, but we got some heavy stuff, some light stuff. Do you guys want to start with the heavy stuff or the light stuff?
Let's go heavy.
All right, this is heavy. And before I read this letter, I'm going to say I don't agree with everything in this letter, but I don't necessarily disagree with everything in this letter. But I will say, and I'm glad Sammy B's on, and maybe not some other people, is I'm going to speak very vaguely here. And if you understand what I'm saying, you'll know what I'm saying. And if you don't understand what I'm saying, listener, then that means I'm being paranoid, which actually is my preferred state, considering the alternative. I fear, and Adam, like, maybe you could nod or look at me like I'm off my rocker.
Both reactions are perfect for an audio podcast.
I fear that perhaps the Punk News podcast is cultivating a certain angle or a certain melange of ideas, if you will, or a certain exterior, which I'm not interested in cultivating that at all. I am interested in independent thought and not necessarily going along with the crowd, but I'm not interested in, I guess, by default, joining a crowd who's based off, I guess, itself being exterior from certain other crowds, if you know what I'm saying. Am I making any sense?
I have no idea what you're saying, John. I'm confused.
That's good. That means I'm being paranoid, so I will jump into this next letter, and I'm happy to hear that. This is from Dallin. He's written in a couple of times. Adam, why haven't you joined Symbol? Sean Crawford will show you the way. I listened to some of John's hip-hop recommendations, and to be honest, none of them really did that much to win me over for the genre. However, I stumbled across an album that blew my mind, A Tribe Called Quest's The Low End Theory. I highly recommend it. And then it continues, and this is what I love about the Punk News podcast is we're not scared to get kind of discuss things in a truthful manner as opposed to, I guess, spout generic PR, if you will. Here's a question. Is it weird that the tacit societal rule for whether it is acceptable to say the N-word is whether or not you have a certain type of skin? That is to say, black people can say the N-word and white people cannot. Is it okay to have different rules for societal norms based solely on skin color? I'll answer that. I'm a pragmatic person. I'm not an idealistic person. And I think if you're not black, you shouldn't ever use the N-word. And if black people want to use the N-word in different contexts, that's really up to them. But I don't think anybody except a black person should ever use the N-word, except in an academic context, obviously.
I don't think anyone really should use that word.
Really? You don't think it's cool, or not cool, but you don't think rappers can say, like, you know, what's up my N or whatever, like they do in their songs?
Well, they're going to do it regardless because, again, yeah, they are saying it in a particular context, but I generally do not like hearing that word. And again, I'm from Brooklyn and I hear it on the streets all the time. I don't really think anyone should use it as a word to describe anyone or, you know, a brotherhood or whatever.
As a Canadian white guy that ticks every privilege box imaginable, I don't really know if I get a say on this one in particular. I would probably want to defer to, you know, someone who's black and have them tell me what they would prefer. I'm going to give it to them.
Adam, let's go towards Dallin's broader picture here in that this rule sort of exists, but it's a little messier, is if you are of a certain ethnic group, you can use that racial slur, but no one else can. Like we could call each other WAPs, Adam, and people couldn't be offended by that. But if someone else called us WAPs, that would be offensive. Do you agree with that rule?
I think maybe that's generally what I was trying to get at. I think it's that, like, whoever's on the downside of these slurs, it's they get to decide how either they want to use it or not use it, or how anyone else is going to use it. I'm okay with that being the general rule for it. So if one of these terms, you know, is something that is particularly slagging off you, well, then you get to decide, you know, how you're gonna, I guess, parlay with it, or how you're gonna use it or not use it, or purpose it or repurpose it. And I don't think that even we need to, you know, say that there's a specific across the board rule that everyone has to follow there. Everyone has their own kind of personal shit, so you deal with it the way you deal.
Stated the rule, though, which I agree with, and the rule is that if you're part of the, I guess, attacked class, then you can co-opt the word however you want.
Yeah, and then I'm not right. Sure, I'm just not recommending that you do co-opt it in one way or another, because again, it's not my decision.
Now, Dowling continues, John, you don't ever talk about Primus, and I have to assume you're not a fan, which is surprising to me. They seem to be right up your alley. They're clever, weird, innovative, and boy, they can really rock your socks off. Explain yourself, sir. You know, I haven't really dug too deep into Primus, but for me, it always just comes off as a little too goofy, a little too cute, a little too self-aware. But recommend the Primus album I should listen to, and I'll check it out. I don't know if I've ever listened to a Primus album all the way through, but I have heard some songs. But for me, it's kind of like Frank Zappa, but a little too, like, too, oh, aren't I like Frank Zappa? Or like, whereas like Ween, for example, Ween, you're never exactly sure if they're being serious or if they're being serious or being goofy or somewhere in between or being weird for the sake of being weird. So recommend me Primus albums, people. And finally, Dowling continues. Finally, I wanted to give an update on the punk, on the punch a Nazi debate. There's a certain group who seemingly no sense of irony calls themselves anti-fascists, who are committing violence against anyone they deem to be a Nazi. The issue is that they get to decide who is worthy of violence and who is not. If we accept the principle of it's okay to punch people you don't like, then there's no due process, no jury, only mob justice. Off my soapbox, keep on rocking, from Dowling.
Oh, people keep tweeting at me about punching Nazis, and I feel like we voiced an opinion on this once, and it was a long time ago, and it is not something we want to wear as our main
this is not the
online signifier forever. But hey, I'm gonna step in here and swerve on that in a different way. The way I'm gonna swerve on that is, I keep hearing people talking about anti-fascists as if it's some group and not just people who are anti-fascist. And I feel that the primary driver in trying to make that some sort of unified group with like an ethos is the right. Like it helps them to build up this boogeyman and make it sound like a fucking terrorist organization or something like that. So I reject the premise that there even is like, you know, the, you know, capital A anti capital F fascists that are out there that are saying X, Y, and Z. I think there's a lot of people that are anti-fascist. You know, a whole shit ton of them fought in World War II, let me tell you. And I'm not engaging with, you know, anti-fascists say this, and on the other hand, the alt-right say that, because the alt-right to me is a more organized group of nutbags, and anti-fascism is just, you know, it's like wiping your ass. It's like something you should probably do.
Sam, any comment on anti-fascism and Adam White's toilet paper analogy? Or you're just gonna flush that one down the drain?
Yeah, we're gonna flush that.
All right. Here's a more lighthearted letter from Patty.
I could have said wash your hands. I'm just
this is from Patty. Hey guys, quick story from the Portland, Oregon. Hey guys, quick scene from the Portland, Oregon punk scene. I use the term loosely, as it is lively but quite small. Recently, the Interrupters toured through, and I saw them for the third year in a row. They were amazing, and I would never miss them. But oddly, they were touring in support of Swimmers. Swimmers, is that Billy Joe Armstrong's son's band? Is that Swimmers?
I think so.
Or is that Divers?
I'm not aware of either.
Okay, well, I'll research that while you guys respond to this letter. Anyway, Patty continues. I say oddly, but that could be from my limited knowledge. I'm not sure why the Interrupters were not headlining, especially considering that after their set, probably 85% of the people left the venue. Perhaps with your superior knowledge of the scene, you could enlighten me as to why that may have been the case. Swimmers is by no means a poor band, but they don't seem to have the draw power. From Patty.
Our superior knowledge in that we didn't know who Swimmers was.
Well,
right?
So I just looked it up, and yes, I can confirm that is Billy Joe's son.
Oh, then I have a concrete answer for Patty, but go ahead, Sam.
Maybe it has something to do with, you know, just him being a son. Things happen. they headline things. It happens.
Here's the answer, from my perspective, is that swimmers, obviously, he's the son of Billy Joel Armstrong. His dad has connections. His dad knows how to do things. So most likely is, and actually, Adam, well, actually, both Sam and Adam might remember this. In 2004, 2005, 2006, there was a crop of bands where the lead guy in the band, like, was the son of, like, PayPal CEO or, like, Amazon's, you know, COO or, you know, I don't know, Whole Foods is, you know, chief accountant, you know, who – so what they would do is they would pump a whole bunch of money into what were essentially management corporations, and they would try to make a band and just throw a whole bunch of money at it. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then these bands would go on these big tours, have these big PR, put out like insane amount of albums, buy a whole lot of ad space. No one had ever heard of these bands, but all of a sudden they're popping up all over. I actually the best example, I don't even know if you guys remember the guy's name. He had like orange hair or whatever, and people like hated him like off the bat. Do you guys remember that guy?
Oh God, we posted a lot of stories about him because they kept sending them to us.
I can't even remember his name.
Yeah, I don't remember his name at all. But was he one of those?
Right.
You know, son of a rich kid. Kind of guys.
The
band that jumped into my head from that era that I think fit that bill, although I will contend that they were kind of cool, at least their songs were kind of cool, was a band called Be Your Own Pet.
Ah, yes. Anyways, yeah. So anyways, I'm not saying that Billy Joe's just throwing a whole bunch of money at people, but what I am saying is Billy Joe knows how, or Billy Joe's management knows how to build a band, if you will. So the reason Interrupters are opening is because the Swimmers management knows Interrupters have a crowd. They want to get people to see this other band. So perhaps foolishly, perhaps wisely, they organized the tour and said to Interrupters, okay, Interrupters, we'll pay you X amount of dollars to open for Swimmers. And so Interrupters, of course, says, sure, we'll go. You know, we're happy to play. Meanwhile, the management is hoping that people will stick around and see Swimmers. It's kind of the reverse. Usually if you're the smaller band, you open. But in this rare scenario in the modern age, that the smaller band is the headliner, if you will, because they're trying to build an artificial fan base, which hopefully will blossom into a real fan base, which actually does happen sometimes.
I mean, these shows happen a lot of the time because, I mean, it's not simply that a show exists with that lineup, or that a tour exists with that lineup, and therefore it happens. Promoters still have to agree to put those shows on. So there's, you know, there's someone upstream that's shopping that tour around to various promoters, and the promoters looking at it and deciding if it's worth their money to actually do it. And in a case like this, it probably is. So you're going to look and you're going to say, okay, you know what, Interrupters draw. We know people are going to show up for them. They're not the first band, but maybe they're the second to last band that's playing. So we know those people are going to show up. They're going to pay to come in. They're going to buy a couple drinks each. And you know what? We're going to make our money off of that. And if you want to put Swimmers at the end, then, you know, hey, that's you know, you're not going to hurt the bar so much as you're going to hurt the ego of the of that band when everyone leaves before they go on. So that's maybe a bit less of a problem from the venue standpoint or from the promoter standpoint. So, you know, those type of things go ahead. You do find, though, that every once in a while there is a good business case for the bigger band, or the, let's not say the bigger band even, but the band with more cred, the band that could be headlining their own show, for them to go open for someone that would be like beneath them. Sounds derogative, but I mean, I'll give you my classic example for this is that, you know, there was a time when Bad Religion did a tour opening for Blink-182, and they opened, this was like right before or after the New America came out, and they went and they played all these, you know, big Blink-182 at the peak of their power shows as an opening act. And, you know, they probably got paid well to do it, but it also, you know, there's a lot of kids that were in those audiences that hadn't necessarily heard Bad Religion before. So, you know, there's that cross benefit there. So, you know, if Swimmers, and again, I don't even know who Swimmers are, so I don't want to speak ill of them. They may draw a segment of people that, you know, and those people have now been exposed to the Interrupters. So there it does benefit both parties sometimes to do this.
Last letter for today. We've got a couple more in the chamber. We'll save those till next week. This is from Liverpool Neil. Hey, chaps. Liverpool Neil here. Just a quick note. I was wondering if you guys had seen the movie London Town and what you thought of it. To those that don't know, it's a 2016 movie about a kid in 1977-1978 London and his brushes with Joe Strummer and The Clash. I have my own opinions, but I'll keep them under wraps so I don't prejudice you guys. From Liverpool Neil. I haven't seen it.
No.
No, I haven't seen it either.
Well, there you have it.
I actually haven't heard of that, and I feel like I've heard of like a fair amount of the Clashy movies and things like that. I probably own most of them, but I have not. That one escapes me. So, okay, something to do there. Is that it, Neil? You don't want to ask us about, like, you know, what we think about this or that genocide or... Like, what was the contrast in letters here, John? The first letter was asking us, like, wade into all of these very... Here's a laundry list of various sticky racial issues and things like that that you, as the Punk News Podcast, aren't fucking qualified to talk about at all. And now, Liverpool Neil's going to ask us if we saw a movie, to which the answer is no.
Whenever I hear, like, Clash in a movie, I always think of that movie, I think Billy Gilman, which I never even saw, but it had, like, Rudy Canfield with the kid, like, dancing across a rooftop or something. Adam?
No.
True.
Infuriating as it may be. That was something. John, we were going to jump into the stories, but then we realized that we had Sammy on here, and Sam...
People love that, Adam. People love that. That's like our most popular segment.
So it might actually make sense to chat a little
Sam,
bit.
Why does Adam always neg the podcast? Why is he always...
Do a little drop in on the... on the consumerism aspect of our show that I'm sure everyone is totally fucking bored by every time. But,
if you don't like it, you can get out
about what we bought.
Week I went way over it. I actually met Sammy B down in Philadelphia because she was down with her husband.
So anyways, okay, well, what are we doing, John? You spent an obscene amount of money.
So I went to three record stores in Philadelphia. I went to Sit and Spin Records. I'm a big fan of Sit and Spin Records. Big fan. It is the punk record store in Philadelphia. And I mean, when I say punk, I mean punk, not like punkish. I mean punk. And they're real cool. I would actually say they're cheap. And also they're really cheap for CDs. And they get in a crazy, like I think punk kids are too cool for CDs now, but I'm not. So I snap up all these cool punk CDs. I got a whole bunch of Morrissey CD EPs, which I love, which I've spoken about a whole bunch before, so I won't talk too much about. But Morrissey always puts these weird, unusual covers, live tracks, B-sides on his CD EPs. And they're kind of expensive and hard to find, but I found a whole bunch of Sit and Spin on CD, and they were cheap, and I love Sit and Spin. Another cool thing that I got was this is cool. Then actually I met Sammy B and Chris at another Philadelphia record store called Long in the Tooth Records, which is a cool record store, certainly one of the better Philadelphia record stores. They've got a crazy selection and that they've got a ton of really, really cool records. Like you could easily spend $300 in there without even trying. They're not as cheap as Sit and Spin. Sammy B and I were talking before the podcast. I think maybe they're a little pricey. Sammy thinks they're fair, and I agree that they're fair, and that if you bought what they're selling off Discogs or eBay, you'd probably pay the same amount after shipping. So it's not cheap, but they have a lot of really cool records. While I was there, I got a really cool Black Uhuru 12-inch EP. What's interesting, you know, Black Uhuru is a famous Jamaican reggae group, and one of the reasons why they're one of the most famous ones is even though they're a Jamaican reggae group, they recorded the European style, meaning their records have a very clear and crisp sound. But what's interesting is Jamaican reggae groups, is when they do a 12-inch single, they'll make, you know, what's called a disco mix, which is a really long, weird version of a shorter song. With the Jamaican groups or even UK reggae groups that record in the European style, I'm thinking Steel Pulse. I'm thinking, I'm trying to think who else. Third World, those kind of groups, they adhere more to the American or European style release, in that, you know, it's got the single will have a track on side A, maybe another track on side B. Black Uhuru is very interesting because their singles is they're recorded in the European style that is a very crisp, clear sound, but then they'll do extended weird dub cuts in the Jamaican style. And I got a really, really cool 12-inch single. It's from the UK because they never made it in America, of What Is Life and Party Next Door. And it also had Solidarity on it. And the A side, What Is Life, is this weird, tripped out, like 9-minute version of Solidarity, song by Black Uhuru, which is really, 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 really cool. And let me think of one other cool thing that I got. I got some, this is cool. And Adam will maybe appreciate this to a degree. For $2, I picked up Pills Home/Round 7-inch single. Pill is an awesome group, and in many ways, I think because Pill is so intense, so noisy, maybe they almost are better in a 7-inch single format, because it's like, all right, I'm going to listen to this 4-minute track that is just pummeling and punishing, and you put it on, it starts, it ends, it does what it sets out to do, and it doesn't have time to get old. It's just such a unique – Pill isn't necessarily catchy, but it's unique and powerful and memorable, and maybe because it's so intense, it's better in short doses. Well, like Rise.
Pill's catchy as shit. It's just they're all over the place depending on kind of like what era you get from them and things like that. But there are Pill songs that are just unabashed hooky pop songs, at least in my mind. But anyways. Yeah, I mean, like Rise, but like shit, like the whole second half of that Greatest Hits record is all just like pop stuff. I find that like Pill's early stuff has a lot more, like back when Jaw Wobble was in the band, right? They did a lot more stuff that was this sort of like weird, you know, particularly bass driven, like dubby kind of stuff. You're like Flowers of Romance and things like that. But you know, as they got into like the latter half of the 80s, there was a lot of like just big, great pop songs that they put out. And in my head, if you listen to, say, like the Greatest Hits collection that The Cure put out, and you compare that to, say, like the Greatest Hits So Far by Pill, like really similar kind of arc between those two bands, where, you know, their early stuff is more discordant and weird.
Ah,
and,
Adam, I gotta add, you know, one more thing. Guess what else I got?
Really, really,
I got
weird
Commercial Zone.
And, you know, you can't find the hook at all, and you're just sort of lost in the
Commercial Zone. Commercial Zone is the early stolen version of
huge,
Pill's fourth album. This is what
not ashamed
of
itself at all.
Get.
Pop music.
And what happened was Keith, at the time, the two main Pill guys were Keith Levine and John Lydon. They got in a big fight, and Keith Levine fled to America with the master tapes.
Commercial
Zone. And he produced his own version of the album as Commercial Zone and sold it illegally. And of course, EMI, the record label, whoever it was, I forget what record label it was, they gave him a cease and desist, so they had it taken off the market. So it is the stolen early version of This Is What You Want album by Pill, called Commercial Zone. Yeah, it was pressed twice by Keith Levine. The first is in a white jacket label. The second has the Pill logo on it. I got the white jacket label version.
Oh, cool. Was it? I mean, this was an older copy.
No, no. You can actually get it for very. I got it for $20. Very reasonable
point, right?
Price.
So
yeah, I generally don't buy super expensive records, honestly. Generally.
Cool. So, like, available though, like, or
I don't like
or
what,
like, you know, was this one of these oppressively expensive?
Well, I mean, a lot of Wall records are like super expensive, but you can buy them anytime you want. So I don't feel like I can get a Misfits Halloween if I want to drop $900, you know. But cool. I don't want to drop $900. Like, if there was only one Misfits Halloween record,
yeah,
instead of spending a couple hundred dollars on it, you know. But because it's always available, I just have to be willing to spend $900. I never really feel compelled to buy it, you know. Whereas certain others. Super rare records. I have like World Inferno's first 7-inch, or the Melvins, what do you call it, a live box set in a wooden crate, which I showed you that, didn't I, Adam? My crown jewel. That is something I had to get, which was very expensive, but because you're not going to get it again. I mean, that is it. So wall records I generally don't buy unless it's something I really, 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 really want and I know I can't get it again. Well,
oh yeah,
it depends. It depends. Long and the Tooth had some pretty cool wall records.
Got it. So you don't like wall records.
Well, Sam, what did you pick up recently?
Oh yeah, they always do. They like to hide the super punk ones right behind the counter. But, yeah, so that's cool. Well, I've been away from the podcast for a really long time, and I actually traveled to Amsterdam and Berlin during the summer and pretty much spent, you know, a few days record shopping with my husband. So we ended up going to 3 record stores in Amsterdam and then 3 record stores in Germany. And picked up, because we actually really, really like Europressus. For some strange reason, it might be mental, who knows, but we do think that it sounds better. There's like more of an oomph to certain records.
Was it a letdown, or was it cool to Ramones? We ended up picking
out a Ramones Rocket to Russia from out there. And we did go to the Ramones Museum, which was a delightful experience. So that just made sense. Things like that. We actually got a Ramones exhibit that came around, I think, last year in Queens, in New York. So, which was pretty much like an entire like collection of things that people had from the Ramones. So there was like, you know, Joey's pants and like, you know, cabs and like, you know, guitars and things like that. It was just, you know, archival, I guess, like things. There was also just show posters that they played with. So it was really interesting seeing, like, you know, the Ramones played with, like, you know, these bands that we talk about on this podcast every now and then, things like that. And then they had like meticulous logs of where they played, what date. Like, for some strange reason, I didn't realize that someone in the band was super organized and took meticulous logs of things. But that was really like interesting to see, because they had like, you know, phone numbers and names of like promoters and all that. So pretty much the Ramones Museum in Germany, in Berlin, was pretty much like a small version of that. It seems like some guy's collection. It was 10 times cooler because there's a cafe attached to it, and the actual museum moved around Berlin a couple times, so they ripped down the wall from the original Ramones Museum and put it back up, and I was able to see all of the bands that, like, I love, like the Bouncing Souls and Red City Radio, like, you know, tag up the wall from whatever year they've been there. So it was really, really cool. I really enjoyed it, and the price for the museum was actually pretty cheap, and you can actually, like, I think it was like €4 or €5 to get into the museum, and then you get a button, a pin, and if you want to pay €9, you get a beer with it. Ooh, walk around the museum with a beer. But yeah, so that happened. Did pick up, I've been wanting to pick up the Muncie Girls, their latest release. I couldn't get it from the States for whatever reason, so I ended up picking up a copy from Europe, which is the one I wanted anyways, because it was like hot pink, because I like hot pink. That's cool. And I like fun colors and things. So that was fun. And then, of course, I've gotten like a million things in my mailbox recently, including the new Prawn record, which I love. So, yeah, got some fun things. I like it.
So I got to give some credit out here to a label called Bruised Tongue that is run out of Ottawa. I had ordered a copy of the new full length from Plasma Lab, which is a Toronto area punk band that has released one of the better punk rock records this year, in my opinion. I'd ordered a copy of that record from them, and it never showed. And I did the Bandcamp thing where you go and follow up on your purchase from the link that is, you know, there's a problem with my purchase, and chase them and you know, it didn't show. I don't know what's happening here. And they didn't give me any flack. They were super gracious. They basically said they would go pop another one in the mail, and then the other one did show. And when the other one showed, they actually threw like two other LPs in the box with it.
That's awesome.
Of this, like, other stuff that the label had released. And they totally didn't need to do that if, like, Canada Post fucked up their shipment. You know, that wasn't necessarily their fault. But I totally appreciate the, the customer service commitment from the Bruised Tongue folks. So that's really cool. I'm, you know, they didn't need to do that. I was very happy about that. Anyways, yeah, everyone should go listen to Plasma Lab. The other thing that I'm sitting here right now that I am is quite cool, and I picked up recently, the dudes in Tough Age went and formed a label called Very Fine Fine. So like VF/FN is the name of the label, and they're going to start to like put out kind of rare, sort of like Canadian underground things that have gone out of press or that never ended up on vinyl or anything like that. So the very first release that they put out is from a band that was originally from Vancouver Island, I think, and they now live in Montreal, called Fountain. You know, Fountain is still a going concern, but the first few things that they released were, they released a couple tapes, cassette tapes, between 2013 and 2015, and that material has never been on vinyl at all, but Very Fine Fine has now gone and put it all together. So one side of this record is the one cassette, the other side of the record is the other cassette. They're pressing like 300 copies of this. You can only buy them from, like, you know, the label on the internet or from the band if you see them. Like, they're not going to bother doing distro or anything like that. They're not going to repress it. So it's a cool record. It's a cool band, and it's like a cool little artifact. So they're a, I don't know how we describe Fountain. Fountain can get weird. Fountain is like, I don't know, they're a post-punk band, let's say. They are all over the place stylistically, depending on what song you're listening to. But Fountain's cool. So, anyways, I like that. I like releases that are put out like with no intention that, you know, they know that they're not going to sell, you know, 30,000 copies of a repress of the first two cassettes from this band no one's heard of. So I like when they can just commit to it and say, like, you know what, we're going to press an incredibly limited number of these, and that's it. But there are certain people like Adam who want them, and here they are. I appreciate that. So, anywho, there's other stuff that's sitting in the floor next to me, but no one wants to hear about that right now. So, let's keep rolling here. Let's go. So, you mentioned Prawn, Sam.
Yeah. So, I am going to play the song by Prawn. This song I really, really, really enjoy. I actually sing it to my dog because I'm a crazy person, and it is called Greyhound.
Just hold along with you. some shelter. But I know you talk right free. 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 You run just to run again.
All right, that was Prawn with Greyhound. We're back. We're going to talk about some of the news that happened this past week. The first one here is that the Lawrence Arms have announced their third annual War on Christmas show. These are, by show, I mean shows. There's multiple of them. They're going to take place at the Cobra Lounge and at the Bottom Lounge in Chicago. And so there's one at the Cobra Lounge on the 14th, and then Bottom Lounge on the 15th and 16th. So yeah, different support on all three dates. They're going to be playing with the Ridgelands and Fuck You and Idiot at the Cobra Lounge on the 14th. They're going to be playing with Teenage Bottle Rocket and Blood People on the Bottom Lounge on the 15th. And then on the 16th at the same venue with Nothington and Sass Dragons. So that's happening. These have become big events, at least as far as the Punk News audience is concerned. Lawrence Arms don't do a whole hell of a lot of touring at this point anyways, but the Christmas shows always seem to be a big deal. So there you go. That's happening. Has anyone gotten out to these?
I have not, but I would love to go to one of these. I've only been to Chicago once. I love Chicago, so I would love to go out to one of these.
I guess actually wider question is there anyone in your neck of the woods that do these kind of like big year end, like Christmas or New Year's shows? The one that always pops into my head, because we used to talk about it sort of year after year after year, was the Mighty Mighty Boston's one, right? Like their hometown throwdown. I don't even know if that's over Christmas. I assume it is. But they have that big, you know, everybody come back, see us play multiple nights thing that they do. Is there anything like that that goes on in the Philly or Brooklyn worlds?
Well, so the Bouncing Souls used to do Home for the Holidays, which was amazing. I love the Bouncing Souls so much. They're one of my favorite, or is my favorite band ever. So it was always, I felt like everyone that went to the shows, like from my area, we all kind of became family, because it's, you know, it's the holidays. It was during, like, right after Christmas. And, you know, we always expected to see each other and, you know, belt out these Bouncing soul songs to get together and, like, you know, hug each other. So, I really like these traditions, because I found those shows to be a tradition for me. Like, I knew that after Christmas with my family, I'm going to go see my real family. my soul's family. like right after, and we're gonna spend a couple nights together, like, you know, just being punks together in the middle of the freezing tundra known as Asbury Park. Plus, Bouncing Souls always magical for me anyway, so you know.
What about you, John? Is there any kind of like annual thing?
Hallowmas, which is the World Inferno Friendship Society annual Halloween show. I did, well, actually, well, I almost went last year. I went the year before and the year before that, and it was awesome. I guess it was 4 years ago now. That was the greatest one ever. That's when the one where it was like the whole month before they were talking about Grace Talicious and how Jack Terrycloth thought she was a great singer, but she tragically passed away. And then outside the show, they had a hearse, and you were supposed to bring in flowers. And so I brought in flowers too, and you laid them in front of Grace Talicious' coffin inside the venue, and she was laying there. And then at the end of the show, an entire like Baptist or some kind of choir, like a Baptist choir, came out, and they sang along with, like, I'm talking about a 30-piece choir, 20-piece choir. They sang along with World Inferno, and they brought the whole casket up to the stage. It was insane. This year is the 20th anniversary of World Inferno's Hallowmaster shows. I'd like to go, but man, I don't know, because Halloween on a weekday, getting up to Brooklyn, yee.
Tell me about it. I live here.
Yeah. So I'd really like to go, but I don't know, man. It's like a Wednesday. Last year I took off like 3 days. It did not work out too well for me. So I don't know.
All right. Well, so I guess if you want details on what's going on with the War on Christmas stuff, you can find more on Punk News, or, you know, maybe go check with Epitaph. Epitaph probably knows. They keep track of what's going on.
They know.
So on the flip side of fun show news, after 19 years as a punk rock club, the Triple Rock in Minneapolis, the Triple Rock Social Club, is going to be shutting down. So the last night will be November 22nd, a little less than a month away from where we're recording. Now, this club has famously hosted thousands of punk bands over the years, and there are even a few songs that have been, that have paid tribute to it. I mean, like the NoFX one, I think is maybe the most obvious one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
That's the one that's I can't hear the name of that club without that song jumping into my head. But yeah, so the Triple Rock closing. They released a statement. I don't know. Let's see. Is there anything in here out of the statement that we need to reread for people?
Not really. However, some punk bands are organizing some final shows. I know War Plague is organizing like a super DB punks show. So I know people are really sad to see this club go.
Well, I think this is like a punk like institution. Like, if you know, especially in the org like world, everyone knows where the Triple Rock is, and like, you know, that shit happens in Triple Rock all the time. There's, you could probably, like, I'm sure, like, everyone in Minneapolis that's a punk just hangs out there and drinks, you know. I'm sad I never got to the chance to go and see a show there. Especially, like, you know, I think seeing a D4 show there would be like amazing. So yeah, I'm sad.
Here's a question I have. When people get sad that a venue closes, is that pure sentimentality, or is there some tangible, like, does a club itself actually matter? Because luckily we're in the position right now that generally most cities have enough clubs for music. It's kind of not hard to find a place to play if you want to play.
Well, I think coming from Brooklyn, and the venues here have been closing left and right, and new things have been opening. You know, for me, it's the sentimentality and like nostalgia and stuff like that. Like, you know, I grew up going to shows at a specific place, and I knew exactly how things were run there. To, you know, and especially since, like, you know, this particular place is super punk, I feel like a lot of it is getting, like, more corporate and, you know, taken over by, like, one or two particular companies. So everything's the same, where there's, like, ridiculous rules and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Actually, Sam, you changed my mind. I was originally of the position that, well, the club itself doesn't really matter, But I agree with you in that the closing of this club kind of represents an entire change of culture, or I guess pressure on a certain type of culture to exist when other areas are pushing it out. I'm reminded of the Golden Tea House in Philadelphia, which when it was open, I talked about it all the time in the Punk News podcast. Golden Tea House was a house show place, and I was gone there all the time. And because it was easy to get to, they had great shows. The people that went there were generally cool, and like a lot of cool up-and-coming bands would play there. But since that got shut down, I haven't gone to as many house shows just because it's not as centralized, but also because the whole vibe and the whole atmosphere and the whole welcoming attitude isn't found in other areas. So the culture itself has changed due to a venue's closure. So I agree with you, Sam. You changed my mind in that single paragraph.
Yeah, well, you know, like it's just the DIY like nature of things. It's especially in New York, there are pretty much no DIY shows that's happening.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like there are no places. Like I used to go to a place called Suburbia. R.I.P. It was pretty much the only place in Brooklyn that would be a $5 show. And it was, you know, pretty much a basement house show in a sense. You know, that got cracked, like shut down. And, you know, the people actually live there, no longer live there. They actually were forced out. But it's, you know, at least in New York, there isn't a place where, you know, a band could just be like, oh, I'm coming through, I'm on tour, I need a place to go. They have to find bars and, you know, pay whatever the bar fee is to play that night, you know, or whatever.
I mean, coming back to what you had, I guess you had said and then retracted already, John. Depending on where you live, the closing of venues is I think more of a crisis than maybe in other places. There's been a ton of noise in this neck of the woods right now because there has been just a huge turnover in venues in Toronto where it was like earlier in the year, like 2 or 3 months into the year, they lost like 7 or 8 pretty big name places all in a row. And a lot of them were like long running rock clubs that had been like home to, you know, all sorts of touring bands and everything coming into the city, but also like participants whenever there's like an inter-venue kind of like music festival thing, like North by Northeast or anything like that. So like places like the Silver Dollar Room was the big one that went, but like it was like Soy Bomb, Hughes Room, like the Holyoke, like a whole bunch of places that all of a sudden, all within a short span, all vanished. And there was like a mini crisis, at least at the time, where there was a music advisory council in the city that had to like convene these emergency meetings to try to figure out like why is all the live music venues all of a sudden vanishing? And like a big reason for it in Toronto is that Toronto has, I think in North America, like one of the hottest real estate markets. So all of that land is like valuable to someone right now. And it was like a huge problem where, you know, there was a lot less places for people to go and play and see bands and all that. So, you know, closing of a venue, depending on where you are, can be a huge deal.
I agree.
So anywho, the triple walk. So I don't know exactly why the triple walk is closed. I said walk, triple walk.
I believe it's because the owner of the real estate did not continue the lease. I'm not sure, but I'm 70% sure.
That always seems to be the case whenever my answer is like, why is this record store I like closing? They seem to be doing well. And it's always something like, well, you know, someone wants to put a vape shop there now. And
or condos.
I realize this is easier said than done, but what I don't know is how can you run a business for 19 years, but then not have enough money to be able to make a down payment on your own real estate? You know, I never quite understand that.
Well,
I mean,
When it comes to the point where they're going to say, okay, you either got to hang it up or you got to make a major capital investment, that there's an urge there to just like rest on your laurels and say like, you know what, we did good, but now it's time for someone else, and you just bow out.
Mm.
like fatigue's got to set in.
True.
At some point, but anyway, yeah. All right, I'm gonna just keep reading the stories here because John, the next section of this show after the song is such a John section that you're gonna take over there. So number three story here: Hamilton, Ontario, proto-punk psych rock band Simply Saucer is gonna be playing a tour in the U.S. A bunch of shows in the U.S. South, a few in the Midwest. Now, Saucer is it's not just them. They're bringing along Craig Bell from Cleveland's Rocket from the Tombs to play bass on this.
Rocket, so, and Sam, Chris and I had a thing with Rocket from the Tombs at the record store.
Was it that or was it Rocket from the Crypt? Because I remember Rocket something. From the Tombs. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Saucer is this kind of like infamous lost proto-punk band that has got back together and started playing stuff, and then you have like Rocket from the Tombs that are like the one of these like canonical proto-punk bands. So Jesse, the drummer in Saucer right now, is jokingly calling this the Legends of Proto-Punk tour, but in any case, so the current lineup of Simply Saucer is the original singer guitarist Edgar Brow, guitarist Mike Treblecock, who plays in the band The Killjoys. They're bringing along a Toronto singer.
Not the
singer
UK named... The Killjoys.
Pardon me?
Not the UK Killjoys, is it?
No, I don't know, actually.
You guys know who the UK Killjoys are, don't you?
We could find this out. You answer your trivia question while I find this out. No, this is the Canadian Killjoys. Hamilton-based Canadian Killjoys, yeah.
The UK Killjoys had a song called Johnny Won't Come Home or something like that. That's Dexy's Midnight Runners before they were Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Oh, yeah, not them. Anyways, also in the band, a Toronto-based singer named Kalina Phillips is playing with them. And then the drummer, Jesse Locke. Now, the whole reason we're talking about Simply Saucer in the music world right now is I'm going to give a lot of credit to Jesse for making this happen. So Jesse is a comparatively young dude. He's the drummer of Tough Age. He's the drummer of Century Palm. He was the editor of a really cool eccentric Canadian music blog called Weird Canada for a number of years up here. And when he was the editor of that, he really got on to, Simply Saucer when they were like a little bit more unknown before they had kind of come back together. And he literally wrote the book about them. So he went and he wrote a book. It's called Heavy Metalloid Music, The Story of Simply Saucer. You know, he made friends with these guys. He wrote the biography and then now he's drumming for them. So he is just like completely tickled. It's like you went and you like found some obscure band. They became your favorite band. You wrote a book about them and now you play in that band. So that's just, Jesse's just having the time of his life with this. So anyways, there's a second edition of his book that has some expanded content in it that's going to be available at these shows. And they're getting ready to go. I know they've actually been recording stuff too, because they've been posting like Instagram studio stuff, but I don't know exactly what any of that is to come of. Simply Saucer's original run was from 73 through 79. They got back together in 2006 and have been like doing stuff at various levels of intensity since then. If no one's ever heard this band, Saucer is this mix between like Syd Barrett, Pink Floyd, some Velvet Underground. There's some Stooges that's in there. It's like, if you just want to make a list of like where all the connective tissue was between like the psych rock era and, you know, the Warhol scene and then coming into punk rock, they touch like every touch point on that. And the record that they had originally, it wasn't even a full length, it was just a collection of demos and some live recordings, was something called Androids. Why am I blanking on here? Androids Are Visited right now, or Androids, hold on, simply, it's sitting in my pile here, and I always,
Well, there's an interesting parallel between them and Rocket from the Tombs, like Adam mentioned. Rocket from the Tombs were the proto Dead Boys band, if you will. And that band also never actually released an album, but there's a collection of demos, which
That's exactly what this is. So my brain was saying Androids Revisited is wrong. It's because it is Cyborgs Revisited is the name of the damn thing. Now, the Cyborgs Revisited was two different sets of music. It was a demo that they recorded in the basement with Bob Lanois. And this was Bob Lanois, the brother of Daniel Lanois. And you know who Daniel Lanois is, John?
I don't know who that is.
Big name producer. Basically, he was the guy that was the producer between like every U2 record that anyone cared about. So really, really big name, like Quebec based producer. So him and his brother back in the 70s had like a basement recording studio, and Simply Saucer recorded a demo down there. So that's half of Cyborgs Revisited, and the other half is a live show that they recorded a year later. So that stuff was all released re-released in 2003 by Sonic Onion. And I'm going to play a song from that now because it drives home how this band is all that sort of like weird mix of influences and things like that I said. So I'm going to play a song called Here Come the Cyborgs, part one, not part two. Part two is different, but this is part one of Here Come the Cyborgs off of Cyborgs Revisited. I'm trying to think of like when the actual recording year of this was. It was 1974. So there you go. So recorded in 1974, way ahead of their time. Super cool. So anyways, this is Simply Saucer. You should go see them. The tour kicks off on November 4th at Beerland in Austin. They're playing New Orleans, Memphis, Nashville, Louisville, and then up to Lafayette, Indiana, Chicago, and Bloomington, Illinois. So you should go do that, people in the States. So here you go. This is Here Come the Cyborgs, off of Cyborgs Revisited by Simply Saucer. back, John. It's your show now.
Oh, all right. Well, let's whip through some of these stories. Lars Fredriksson and the Bastards, they're releasing their first live record. It's just going to be called Live and Loud, and it's going to be out on Record Store Day. And I guess quite amusingly, it's taken from their tour of their first record. Quite amusingly, it's kind of got this cheesy, lo-fi, low-budget cover in an homage to those semi-legit, semi-bootleg UK subs. Live albums, exploited live albums, all those, you know, mid-80s live punk albums that are not exactly authorized, but not exactly bootleg either. People see, actually, this blew up on Facebook, so it just goes to show that people still love Lars Fredriksson and the Bastards, and that Rancid will always have pull, I guess, or not always, but for a long time will have pull. I gotta say, just quite coincidentally, I listened to the first Lars Fredriksson and the Bastards album about a week before this news came out. I was digging it.
I was really into that at the time. That was like I was like the biggest Rancid fanboy for a few years, and I was looking through the track listing here, and like I could hum you like most of the songs on this, and I'm sort of embarrassed about that. But yeah, like I instantly know what all these songs are. The kind of nice thing is that none of this shit has anything to do with Viking.
Yeah.
Because Viking was bad, John. Do you remember Viking?
Oh, I remember Viking, and I remember the insert and how I just, even as a youth or a general youth, I had to turn my nose up at its decadence and crassness, if you will.
Yeah, John, I keep knocking cassette tapes over, and they happen to be cassette tapes that you've made, so that's what all that clacking noise is in the background.
Go out and buy Bullshit Collector, kids. Still copies available.
So if anyone doesn't remember Viking, the second album that Lars Fredriksson put out, I don't remember too much about the music that was on there, per se, but yeah, the liner notes for it were just like, were they not just full of naked women?
It's Lars Fredriksson, and like he's surrounded by naked women, and he's like trying to imply that he's cool and can have any girl he wants, and that's why he's surrounded by naked women.
It may have been done as some sort of art piece.
I think it did not
connect on the level of art piece. It was just kind of crazy.
Yes. Yeah.
There should never be one dude and a whole bunch of naked women on anything, really. Even as an art piece.
I would agree with that, especially if you're Lars Fredriksson.
Yeah.
Viking. Wow.
If this live album is relatively inexpensive, I'll buy it. But if it's like $30, I'm not going to buy it. But I don't know, man. I love live records. Punkers hate live records for some reason. I love live records. I love them. Sam, do you like live records?
Not really.
Why?
I don't know. Sometimes live records. I do have a couple of records that's live. And they just don't sound clean. I'm not all about like the overly produced either. But I just don't like live records. I just don't. I do.
How about you, Adam White? Oh, go ahead, Sam. I'm sorry. Oh,
I do love my Bouncing Souls live record. from Generation Records, because I was actually there that day.
That's cool. That's always cool when you have a live record when you were at the show.
Yeah. Love that.
The evidence of my record collection says that I don't really care too much about live records, I guess. I mean, I don't have anything philosophically against them. I'm looking and I'm trying to think of like what I even own that's a live record, like Live at Leeds. Yeah, but everyone owns that.
I love them, man. They're savage. They're raw. You don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes the songs are harder, crazier, and faster. I love live records. Let's talk about something else that everybody loves. Mean Jeans and Mountain Dew. In true Mean Jeans style, for no reason whatsoever, I don't think they're getting paid. I would actually bet they're not getting paid to do this just because it's Mean Jeans. Mean Jeans released a 90-second Mountain Dew. I wouldn't call it a jingle. I would call it a pop-punk tribute to Mountain Dew. And this song is wonderful and hilarious and just underscores how great Mean Jeans is.
Wonderful captures the essence of this tribute song. I need to listen to more Mean Jeans. I really damn do. And I'm not like a fan of Mountain Dew, but I found this entire, I was, you know, listening to it today, and I just found it so delightful for some strange reason.
Your Mountain Dew's nasty as hell, isn't it?
Yeah, the fact that it's like neon, like yellow green, kind of worries me. If like, you know, you're consuming it a lot, it's kind of is it like kryptonite? Is it like, you know, Ninja Turtle goo? Who knows?
Okay. Yeah, Mountain Dew's gross. I'm not going to argue that. It's gross because, as we established on the last episode, John, we're not 16 years old anymore, and we don't understand what the kids are into. So the Mountain Dew is just in that same in that same thing. I imagine, are kids into Mountain Dew? Like, kids in the 90s were into Mountain Dew.
I think kids that were dirtbags in the 90s are still into Mountain Dew, but I don't think modern kids are into Mountain Dew.
This is fun. The only thing is, did they not miss a tiny opportunity to take this too far?
Oh, you think it could have went further with it?
Like it's a straight tribute to Mountain Dew. It is about how they need Mountain Dew. that is it. There is no there's no joke to it outside of the premise, right?
Ah, Adam, I'll go ahead, Adam.
But like, they could have had some opportunity, I feel like near the end of the song, when everyone sort of settled in, to just like to do something wildly inappropriate lyrically. And that, I don't feel that they did that, or at least they didn't do it and I didn't hear it.
Adam, I'm going to counterattack you with the same counterattack you did to me with the Ted Leo video. If the listeners remember, there was that Ted Leo video, which was pretty funny, but I forget the name of the song, but it's him basically doing like a Hall & Oates type song, and he's like sitting at a piano and it's kind of schmaltzy. You guys remember that video and that song?
Yep.
Yeah.
And Adam, you said, I said, Katie Goodman has some videos where they're kind of cutesy-wootsy, but they all end at the end with her like brutally murdering people. And I said, don't you think the video would be more interesting if Ted Leo did something unexpected at the end? And your comment to me was, no, that's enough. The joke exists as its own thing. If you punctuated at the end with something shocking, it would kind of destroy the entire premise of the thing. I agree with that here with the Mountain Dew, and that it's kind of like Ween. Are they being serious? Are they making fun of Mountain Dew? Are they being genuinely appreciative? You can't really tell. It's only 90 seconds. I think if they punctuated it with a joke at the end, a guar type thing, it would be too much and maybe too obvious. I like that it is kind of almost a straight ode just to Mountain Dew and how much they love it.
I guess like the reason that I was looking for that was that without it, you're so close to the line about like Mountain Dew could take this and run it as a little commercial for themselves if they wanted.
Well,
like,
listen, maybe they're trying to make that sweet, sweet cash. And I don't begrudge Mean Jeans making that.
Well, I mean, they could outright state that they don't want that dirty Mountain Dew money by, you know, making the last few lines of the song something about, like, you know, using Mountain Dew to drown a baby or something, right?
But I think maybe they do want the money. I think maybe they do want the cash.
Well, doesn't everyone want more cash in some way? So, like, you know, if corporate does find this somehow, maybe through Punk News, who knows, and they're like, oh my god, this is amazing, because, you know, right now isn't everything, a lot of things is about nostalgia. A lot of the mass media that we see on TV is about, like, reaching out back to our youths and, like, bringing something back, right? I was like, maybe this is a way of them saying, hey, let's make money off of it. Maybe it's not. Maybe they really love it. I don't know. Ask the band. They might tell us. Who knows?
Do you guys think Mean Jeans are kind of like the 80s dirtbags that they project themselves as in their songs?
I don't think so. I don't know.
So you think like there's a lot of band people that I know that project Dirtbag vibe, and I feel that when I see them not in the band, they're still projecting Dirtbag vibe. So I'd be willing to believe that.
Well, fair enough. Well, listen, we've had some yucks, we've had some laughs. We got two sad stories. One that's pretty sad. One that is sad, but might have a positive ending. We'll see. First off, Martin Eric Ein of Celtic Frost has passed away. Formed the band Hellhammer with Tom Gabriel Warrior or Tom Gabriel Fisher or Tom G Warrior, same guy. Hellhammer was a very important thrash black death metal band from Sweden, 1982, 1981, 1983. Actually, I said he didn't form the band with him, but he joined the band. I'm sorry. Then after Hellhammer fell apart, he formed Celtic Frost with Tom Gabriel Fisher. Celtic Frost is without question one of the world's most important metal bands, most important thrash metal bands. They're important because they have very dark, very heavy, very contemplative, very intellectual lyrics, but they also have a lot of really weird stuff. On their album Into the Pandemonium, they covered Mexican Radio, that song Mexican Radio by I forget the name of the band that did that for some weird reason. But then I guess what also was interesting about Celtic Frost is they had perhaps the greatest, if not one of the greatest, comeback album of all time, Monotheist, which is why they considered a metal classic, which is, you know, generally metal bands make their, you know, their best stuff early on and then kind of repeat themselves. Celtic Frost is very interesting in that they released maybe or probably their very best album, Monotheist, as their comeback album after 10 or 12 years, but also the final album in their 25-year career or so. Tom G. Warrior said basically he had a very good quote that I thought was well put. He said, "I am deeply affected by his passing. Our relationship was very complex and definitely not free of conflict, but Martin's life and mine were very closely intertwined since we first met in 1982. And I think Celtic Frost was a famously very volatile band, and Tom Fisher has a lot of fights with a lot of different bandmates. I think it would be disingenuous to me if he'd say, oh, he's the best guy ever, I love the guy, he was like a brother. But I think he paid respect to the guy while being truthful to the relationship. I think that was a well-done statement, if you will.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't really have anything to add to these
Listen, if you haven't checked out Celtic Frost, you got to check out Celtic Frost. You got to check out Monotheist, and you also have to check out their second album, which is probably – well, it's a thrash classic. It's called Tomegatherion, which is a thrash classic, and then Monotheist, which is the comeback album, is a kind of avant-garde, I guess, sort of death, sort of black metal album. But not really. They also have their weird album, which is called Into the Pandemonium. Then they have their classic thrash album, which is the first one. And then they've got Vanity Nemesis, which is kind of like it's not one of the better albums, but it's a solid album. Then they also have one called Cold Lake, which is them kind of doing hair metal, but not really. That's the one you want to check out last. So you want to check out Tomegatherion and also Monotheist first. Amazing, amazing band if you like metal. Last story of the evening. Genesis Peorge of Throbbing Gristle has been diagnosed with leukemia. Genesis has canceled all upcoming tour dates. However, from Genesis' statement, Genesis appears to still be fighting the disease and seems to have high expectations, and we all wish Genesis the best in beating the disease. I was surprised that a lot of people in the punk community didn't know who Genesis Peorge was. I thought everybody knew who Genesis Peorge was. Genesis Peorge founded Throbbing Gristle, which was a proto-industrial, proto-avant-garde, just straight-up super weird noise group. Not even music, just noise. Extremely experimental. And I guess following in the wake of the Velvet Underground, you could say that Throbbing Gristle is the first experimental noise group, and that they didn't even try to make music at all. They made noise. And I think they're kind of the first group to do that, or at least the first group to do it to any really notice. And then after Throbbing Gristle broke up, Genesis formed Psychic TV, which was not as harsh as Throbbing Gristle, but certainly as experimental, certainly as weird, and had very many permutations. Some of the permutations are almost a punk band. Some of the permutations are almost a dance band. Some of the permutations are a noise band. Just, they have over 100 albums, like extremely prolific, maybe not always that careful on content editing, but always going for it, if you will, and never resting on their laurels. So hopefully Genesis gets better. One thing I noticed about this, and that, well actually, the story of Genesis is pretty interesting. So Genesis was born a man, and then sometime during Psychic TV, Genesis married a woman called Lady J. And at that time, Genesis and Lady J decided to become the same person, so they both got surgery. I guess Lady Jane to make herself more masculine and Genesis to make himself more feminine. So they got a lot of plastic surgery to make themselves look exactly like each other. And Lady J passed away some time ago, but trippy, far out people.
Yeah, I had no idea who this individual was until, I had to look them up. And it's just... You know, I come from a very artsy-fartsy background, so just reading everything about this person, I was like, wow, this is a true artist. This person has, like, evolved and has taken in such a unique way of life and outlook in life, where, 'cause essentially the plastic surgery and all that, sounded to me like it was kind of like an art
project. As yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I thought it was very interesting. But yeah, it's this very avant-garde.
Genesis's life itself is avant-garde, yeah. You know, with the...
Go ahead, Adam. This is one of these artists that... whenever you talk about them, it draws that line in the sand where a lot of the punk news readers that still approach the music as, you know, four straight white dudes in a band, this really throws a whole lot of shit in their faces all at once. You know, there's so much to process if your main entry point into say like underground music or anything like that is, you know, you like some Green Day records or something, and then you started listening to, you know, other bands that were maybe more underground than Green Day, to get from that world to the like the Throbbing Gristle Psychic TV world, there's a gulf between those two things, and I'm always amazed to see how this kind of stuff is reacted to on punk news, just because it challenges like any and every, you know, preconception that you may have about, like, you know, the way you would expect. The way you'd expect something to look, the way you'd expect, you know, the band to conduct themselves, the personalities in it, like, this is way, way, way out there on the edge. So on the one hand, I don't fault too much the punk news readership for acting completely dumbfounded, because, you know, if I was in my younger years, I would have looked at this and just been flabbergasted.
I will say I love Genesis, and you should go on Punk News and check this out. I love Genesis, like, PR picture or their picture I know right now with trans people that there's a certain a way to refer to someone's gender. I think Genesis doesn't use those words because Genesis doesn't necessarily see Genesis itself as transgender. Genesis sees something I think Genesis refers to itself as we and it. I think I'm not even exactly sure.
They were trying to merge with another human being through surgery. So I don't know if that falls into the same ballpark as gender identity, and if it's So it's something else in its entirety. So there.
Genesis is so far out, we can't even define what Genesis is. But anyway, the point being is, I love Genesis PR. Like, so many PR photos is four straight white guys, you know, standing in front of a brick wall. Four straight white guys walking down railroad tracks. Four straight white guys kind of smiling, looking in different directions. It doesn't really say anything about them. You look at Genesis' picture here, you know what Genesis is about. You know what I mean? There's a trident in one hand, like some kind of a rain stick in another. There's all this jewelry hanging all over, you know. Genesis is wearing like a bear cape, it looks like. Like, you look at this picture, you know what's going on with this picture. That's why I really like this PR picture, and I wish more bands were more, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for, thoughtful with their PR pictures, not just them standing there kind of smiling in flannel.
I don't think it's a bear that's on her, like Genesis. I think it's more of a heavenly aura that is radiating from Genesis' head. again, the very artistic, you know, curation of this image.
I'm going to go one further for you here, John. Genesis does not have a bearskin thing on. There is a fucking nebula behind them. Like, it's like the Horsehead Nebula or something like that. So they have draped themselves in the power cosmic, John. This is, well, yeah.
Well, along those lines, let's play a Psychic TV song. I don't know which song I'm going to play because they have literally like over 1,000 songs. So I'm just going to pick, I guess, one of the more approachable songs, but not one of the most approachable songs. It'll be far out. This is Psychic TV. Genesis, we hope you get better. You are truly one of a kind.
You're living, thinking, mad, deadly, worldwide, communist, gangster, computer god, secret, overall plan, worldwide living death Frankenstein slavery to explore and control the entire universe with the endless stairway to the stars, namely the man-made inside-out planets.
Outworms from I am higher. It's a jigsaw, it's a core war. What the hell are we fighting for? It's a jigsaw, it's a core war. What the hell?
Actually, I shouldn't say that. I should say Genesis is two of a kind because Lady J. I just insulted Genesis. I didn't mean to. Genesis is two of a kind.
This is fraught, John. We should just apologize for this whole show and shut up.
Just apologize for punk news in general. Just for existing. We should apologize for existing.
We're so sorry.
So anyways.
so sorry.
So that's the end of the show. If anyone wants to write us any email, podcast@punktins.org is how you do that. I don't know why I started the blank on that. It's never been different. John, you're here all the time. Sam, any parting words of wisdom for the people?
Punk News is so sorry about all of this.
All right. Cool.
That was a good ending. That was a real good ending.
I guess.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@velourundergroundstudios.com.